The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It's just about to turn 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 1st of September 2023. How are you all doing? I do hope you're very well, and hopefully you're with us now for the next 3 hours in this show throughout the day on Highland Radio, of course. Lots coming up in the programme, as you heard. We've That's Entertainment between 11 and 12, including €10,000 being given away to one of our lucky listeners. But the first hour is dominated by our Friday panel. We want you involved in the conversation just before we introduce them to you. WhatsApps and text to 086 60 25000. If you're listening outside the Republic, 00353 86 60 25000. Or give us a call on 07491 25000. And a reminder for you that you can watch the programme live on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland, on your smart TV, your Fire Stick, laptop, tablet or mobile phone. We're on Facebook as well, and indeed on Twitter. Okay, so all that's out of the way. Let's say good morning to our guests. Welcome back, Professor Pat O'Connor, Professor of Sociology and Social Policy, Emeritus, University of Limerick. How are you keeping?
Hello, Greg. Hope you can hear me.
Loud and clear. Have more faith. Have more faith, Pat.
You just never know.
I know, but listen, we're here. Reverend Mark Lockridge, pastor of New Life Fellowship and the Reformed Presbyterian Church. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me back on.
No, it's our pleasure. And last but certainly not least, delighted to welcome onto the show for the first time, Claire Ronan, presenter of Up and Running Business Show on Ocean FM and columnist as well with the Sligo Weekender and just general contributor and opinionated person, Claire. I don't know, how would you frame yourself?
Well, there you go, an opinionated person.
That's
a compliment,
what I am.
Greg.
Yeah, I think it is a compliment, isn't it? I hope it is. Come here, Claire, I'll start with you. You know, we're waking up this morning to a concrete levy. We're waking up to more expensive petrol and diesel. We're waking up to more expensive groceries and generally the cost of living because of inflation. There's something else that's gone up today. Yes, VAT on hospitality restaurants. And in restaurants and what have you. There's three of those that are in the gift of the government. Of course, inflation is inflation, but it's a peculiar move, or is it, to be introducing these increases in our everyday expenses during a cost of living crisis? Can you make sense of the decision?
No, I really can't. And that's the honest truth. I think we might start seeing some more positivity coming nearer the election. I think the budget may be a little bit of a giveaway budget, but they're going to be looking for votes. They're going to be knocking on our doors. And as you see, Greg, probably as much, if not more than me, people are really, they really are cut to the pin of their collars, if that's the correct expression. September for families is a really, really difficult month because you have to get all the children back to school. And that in itself caused huge problems at the beginning or the middle of August when people were buying. So even more added on to that. I have a friend who told me recently that her mortgage has gone up €400 a month and her shopping has gone up €400 a month. And both she and her husband had taken a cut during COVID and still haven't had their salaries recompensed. So, you know, there's a €16 billion surplus. We're supposed to be loaded with money. And yet the person out on the street doesn't seem to be feeling the effects of that.
Are these moves to try and address inflation internally then? Because, you know, the bottom line is how do you deal with inflation? You make it more difficult for people to live. You know, and the mortgage interest rates probably aren't going to have the effect because I think it's about 63% of the Irish population with a mortgage have fixed rates. So if you're trying to suppress inflation, maybe mortgage rates increases aren't the best way to do it. If that's what they're trying to do, I think people would appreciate being told that's what they're trying to do. Instead of framing it that, you know, the petrol and diesel has to go up because it's locked in. It's only locked in, like I locked in coming to work today, but I could have stayed on in bed as well.
And I was actually shocked that they increased the VAT for the hospitality and for the hairdressers. I thought, now normally, you know, you'd hear on every radio station and you'd see in all the papers the objections to it, but I can't believe that it actually happened. Now, one thing that I did see recently that I thought I was impressed with was the increase in the bank levy to, say, the banks that were handling all the distressed funds. They should be paying more. How much that will contribute, I don't know, but everything is worth getting. I don't know. Is this their way of handling inflation? Is there a cleverer way of doing everything? But what I do know, Greg, and you know it too, is that people are suffering and that's not good. And I think restaurants, you know, we hear it all the time. Restaurants have been suffering in the Northwest because of the lack of beds and people aren't coming to stay in Donegal and Sligo and Leitrim as much as they were. And now with the VAT rate going up, I think there'll be a lot of doors closing. And I think that's more people under pressure.
Yeah, because even a restaurateur sat opposite me, and he is also a consumer as well as a service provider, there comes a point when a main course is too much or a starter is too much or the cost of lunch is too much, and you start going out, if you do go out regularly once or twice a month, you start going out on a Christmas, or not on Christmas, but on a birthday or anniversary. Professor Pat O'Connor, can you see, and again, I would love, although it might not be possible for someone to say, yes, it's a great move, but can you see any logic to VAT going up for the cost of getting your hair cut, going out for something to eat, staying in a hotel, filling your car with petrol or diesel, building a house if you're buying concrete, for crying out loud? First-time buyers are faced with extra bills. It's unbelievable stuff. But anyway, Pat, what do you think?
I think that, yes, there's a huge problem. I suppose I do feel that the hoteliers have kind of spoiled it for a lot of people. That I mean, that the actual cost of getting overnight stay in Dublin, like, you don't want to own the bed, you just want to sleep in it, you know. I mean, really, it has gone beyond a joke, and there seems to be no way of actually curtailing that. I'm sick of listening to the reps for the hoteliers coming out and saying, well, on average, and other than on special occasions, etc., etc. But to be honest, every weekend in Dublin can be portrayed as a special occasion. So, and you have to remember that the oil is sitting in Dublin. So obviously, some people are having to, who don't have their own accommodation, some of the TDs, are acutely aware of the hoteliers' greed. But I think in a way, like doing things like increasing it on the price of diesel and petrol, this is completely mad and unintelligible. This business that the petrol and diesel was bought ahead. Like, the funny thing is that the prices seem able to rise at a fixed time very fast, but they can never seem to fall quite so quickly. It doesn't make sense. Equally, like the hairdressers, jeepers, I thought, I mean, already, like, we pay an extortionate amount to get our hair cut, not mind to get anything else done. For many people, not for me, this is a kind of a really important event in the week. So increasing that, I mean, in a way, it's putting pressure on a very, very small luxury.
Do you feel particularly sympathetic towards restaurants? Because, you know, I mean, obviously we know our hotels here, and people will have one-off stories about weekend rates. But generally speaking, I think there's better value to be had across the Northwest in hotels. But there is definitely some gouging that's been going on in the cities. I kind of feel sorry for restaurants, and I think maybe they could have done more to try and decouple them from the accommodation VAT. Because that, as you quite rightly pointed out, this is to punish the big hotels in Dublin, and you've got restaurants and cafes around the Northwest who you can still get a breakfast for £9.50. It's punishing them. It's terrible.
Well, you see, the difficulty with the Northwest is getting there, and that's the petrol and diesel problem, do you know? That it is the cost of travelling there. But I am surprised that the restaurants haven't tried to decouple. I suppose what is also partly the Airbnb issue and the lack of enforcement of that has played into the whole frustration with accommodation. But the restaurants seem to have made no attempt to decouple.
Well, you see, the problem is they, and it's not a problem, but perhaps a reality, is they seem to be represented by one person on Twitter who's on News Talk now and again. And Adrian Cummins is the gentleman's name, and I'm sure he's trying his darndest, don't get me wrong, but it is not a powerful enough lobby to have the one voice, because what happens is then shows don't book him because, oh, we had him on a Monday and we can't have him on a Thursday. You know what I mean? It just, it's not, if I were giving them marketing advice, it's not the best approach. And that's not a criticism of him. It's just in terms of getting the message out there. Mark Lockridge, Referent Mark Lockridge, can you say any logic to any of the announcements today?
No, I think logic seems to be in some ways sadly lacking. You know, we have this cost of living crisis. We have the timing seems poor in terms of the cost of living crisis, in terms of people going back to school and the sheer burden on families. But then you add in we have a housing crisis and we have people coming to university in towns where there isn't accommodation for them. We've got I've so many people have been contacting me at various times in the last year to find accommodation in not even simply in Donegal, but people from the continent coming to study here for looking for accommodation in Limerick or Cork. And then we're putting a levy that's going to impact the building of new accommodation. Instead of making it easier, we're making the whole thing harder to provide accommodation, to provide housing. It is hard to get your head around unless it's the, oh, look at all these terrible taxes. And then as Claire said, oh, look how kind we are when it comes to election time. See what we've done, see what we've given you. As if they're banking on our short-term memory.
Yeah, but I don't think the electorate are going to swallow that anymore. I think there's a far more of awareness. But Mark, and just in a reference to what Claire said about this rainy day fund, 16 billion and counting, okay? I mean, we heard what's happening on in CALMS at the moment, mental health services for young people. We know what's happening in our hospitals. We know what's happening with An Garda Síochána Conor and so on and so forth. Like, if this is not a rainy day whereby we spend the money that we have in a targeted way to try and improve the lives of people, to try and lift more people out of poverty and children out of poverty, if it's not bad now, like, you do wonder, is it World War III that they're holding on to this money for, or what is it? Now, Sinn Féin may well be in power in the next government and may very well decide that that's the right way to go and to sustain it for reasons I don't understand. So I'm not saying this is necessarily a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael thing, but they're the party in power with the Greens, the parties in power with the Greens. So, like, you do wonder, what are we holding on to this money for, Mark, if it's not to help people right now?
I think there is something profoundly immoral in having money set aside and not using it. You know, over the centuries, that's sort of been the ideal, that those who had were to help those who have not. And if the government has, and they have, particularly when they have because people have given through taxes and so on, it is their moral obligation and responsibility to provide care for the nation. And yes, if this isn't a rainy day, what is?
I mean, yeah, of course, this is multinational tax and all that kind of stuff, but it's the people of Ireland that are working in these companies that are making them powerful and successful. Now, of course, some of it just passes through here. But Claire, I'll put the same question to you, and it's a genuine question that I'd ask off air. It's not loaded in any way other than it is predisposed to being loaded. What are we waiting for? What are we are still writing down our debt to some extent still. We've increased in that regard. But what is this pot of cash for? Like, can we any of us imagine us having, you know, 100 grand in the bank and our children in the house starving and unclothed?
You know, I think that if you were to get a politician on, they will come up with some long, convoluted, hard to understand reason why this can't be used for the ordinary public. And there has been great speculation in the media, and I'm sure you've covered it on your own show a lot, about what they should do with the 16 billion, including putting a track out to Dublin Airport in Dublin and all these wonderful plans that don't include the Northwest that I ever hear about, except on your show, maybe. I think the government have a problem, and I think you could be very right. I think there could be a situation where we find ourselves with a new party in power next after the next election, because people are sick to the back teeth. And as you said earlier, the big problem here is communication. Greg, if somebody came out and explained to us, and that we didn't have to have this conversation, and told us, right, this is the money and this is what we are doing with it, in simple, clear language, we wouldn't have the people as upset or as disappointed as they are. Mm. The government are losing people's trust. Okay. And it's not good.
All right, before we take a break, Pat, I just want to put it to you. Both Claire and Mark referenced, you know, maybe giveaway budgets. But we have surveys and we have the sense of the people on shows like this. The public would prefer money invested in improving services rather than an extra €1,000 in your back pocket or €2,000 in back. That is the will of the people. So I don't know, unless that's what they're going to give away in a budget, they really don't have their finger on the pulse, I'd suggest, Pat.
Yes, absolutely. I suppose there has always been the historical kind of economic argument that soft money should be spent on ongoing expenditure, that it should be spent on infrastructural projects, right? And we get a little bit of that on the media, but not really spelt out. But mostly what the government seems to me are doing are giving a series of individual explanations. So CAMHS, for example, is explained we can't get the people. The Gardaí is explained by we can't get the people. A series of individual explanations. But what irritates me is that, you know, the reason we can't get the people is because the working conditions and the salaries aren't good enough. And I suppose what I also think is very ironical, that there is no question of anybody at the top being sacked because they can't get the people. Mm-hmm. The only person it appears that anyone is willing to give the push to is Vera Powell, you know. Hello. The whole thing, it is just, you know, it's almost comic.
But do you know what you talk about infrastructural? You know, like, they talk of, and I get that. So you spend, you don't want really to lock in into the long term, short-term money, i.e. this windfall money from... But let's not talk about infrastructure then as bricks and mortar. Let's talk about infrastructure of building a proper health service and then discover how we fund it from general taxation to the future. Build a proper mental health service. Let's call that infrastructure and not worry about roads.
Exactly. But that has never... I have never managed to get agreement on that point. And it is just a coincidence that most of the infrastructure that we should be building around people, health, mental health, childcare, education, all of those involve predominantly female staff. So I kind of think, well, isn't that a coincidence? Whereas building golf courses, cars,
Viagra,
blow me, you know, that's jobs for very important jobs for men. But childcare, oh no, that's, you know, we've been promised a Scandinavian childcare model for God, 15 years, right?
And your opinion on childcare is backed up by a study this week which shows that women, primarily who are the carers still, and it's not always the case, but primarily are. Not able to go to work. They're literally stuck in the house because they cannot get, because of childcare, because of the crisis in childcare. Okay, listen, we could go on that subject forever. Claire Ronan, thank you so much. Professor Pat O'Connor, Reverend Mark Lockridge. More from our guests after this quick break. Our guests are Reverend Mark Lockridge, pastor at New Life Fellowship and Milford Reformed Presbyterian Church, Claire Ronan, presenter of Up and Running Business podcast stroke show and columnist with the Sligo Weekender, and Professor Pat O'Connor, professor of sociology and social policy, emeritus, University of Limerick. It's a word, emeritus, that I actually struggle with, and I'm about 50. If that was $1 million question on who wants to be a millionaire, I would actually take the 500 grand on how I just pronounced that. But anyway, be that as it may. I'll stay with you, Professor O'Connor, if that's okay. And if it should, when should gender identity be taught in schools? Going through the new curriculum there's quite a bit on it. In fifth and sixth class in national school, is that too early? Is that the right time to start talking about these things?
Well, it seems to me that I'm going to take a side angle on this. It seems to me the underlying problem is othering, to call it. Do you know what I mean? That we look at people, children look at people, but adults particularly look at people and focus on their differences, right? Whether those are gender or colour or race or ethnicity or disability or whatever. And in a way, this causes a lot of problems reflected in bullying, isolation, marginalisation, mental health. And so I think that one of the key things that should be being done and is being done in some schools, but not in all, that the things that should be done is focusing on diluting this otherness, right? So, for example, in the case of gender, I'm aware of the fact that some schools don't do this, but a lot of schools still line up the boys against the girls and effectively reinforce a binary construction of gender. And from that comes ideas about who is best, who is superior, but also embedded in it is a very rigid construction of what it is to be a boy and what it is to be a girl. So boys don't wear pink, boys like tech trucks, boys play football, boys, girls don't do X, Y, and Z. There's greater latitude for girls, ironically, but not in terms of often in terms of once you come to sixth, whatever, in terms of who's best. Right. So my approach would be much more lateral in the sense of really toughening up on school curricula and school policies on bullying and enforcing them and deconstructing the whole what it is to be a boy or girl and stopping the practice of actually reinforcing a binary construction, i.e. that these are the boys and these are the girls and they are two ends of a spectrum.
Yeah, but that's sort of trying to make us all the same. Everyone's different, but your identity is individual, and people want to be seen as for who they are. And it's easy, I suppose, if you're in the majority to sort of say, right, look, we're all kind of the same, so we'll not really talk. But that doesn't give a person their identity.
Well, I mean, that you're saying exactly the point I'm making, but more long-windedly, that your identity is individual, right? Whereas, in fact, we've got locked into the idea that, you know, that gender is a key marker. And in fact, one of the things that is ironic about the whole trans debate is that they're reinforcing binaries. They're reinforcing basically the distinction between male and female. I think that is not helpful.
Okay.
And that actually focusing on all the things, like we don't think, you know, just because you're tall, you know, if you're the tall or you're fat or you're old or you're grey hair, you're red haired or whatever, that from this comes all sorts of things. These are all part of our identity. But in a way, like, you know, it's an individual thing, yes, but we have actually turned it into a collective thing, which it has from which.
So that sort of means then. So that would mean too, and I'll bring our other guests in, of course, in a moment too. That means sort of really an end to women's campaigning for equality, for an example, or that kind of brings to an end people of colours because you know the starting point would be, look at, we're all the same. Calm down, everyone. So how do people then? How do we then encourage more women to get into STEM subjects in the environment that you describe? Because that would be.
No, well, actually, I mean, one of the key things about actually changing the position of women in society is that men must take that burden. And part of the problem that why we have made so little advance over such, well, it seems to me relatively like during my lifetime, yes, we have made advances, but we could have done much better if men had actually, you know, focused on their daughters and their wives, their mothers, their lovers, I don't care who, but had actually taken the issue, the burden. Equally, we would have made a lot more progress on poverty
okay.
if the rich had done a little more.
Right. I'm going to ask you the original question, if that's okay, Claire, because I don't want, I mean, and you can talk to Professor O'Connor's points if you so wish, but just to the specific question, like, do you believe gender identity should be taught in schools? And at what age do you believe that should start, Claire?
I do believe, actually, I've been thinking about this, that gender identity should be taught in schools simply because it's a professional teaching the children as such. I think I would say 16, but I do realise that I'm not being realistic and that it probably should be about 12 or 13 when they hit puberty. I always worry that, you know, I have 5 children now, they're all grown up now, but I would be very concerned about a child attending a school who has questions about their gender, who may not feel the same as everybody else. And at least if there was a professional person coming in and talking to them about a topic, even if it's only one child in the whole school, that it normalises it for a start, and also it might answer some of their questions.
But just in relation to that, Claire, as a counterpoint, you talked about it maybe being one in a school, but this is, as you say, just as people are hitting puberty, do we not have to make sure, and I'm not sure we are doing so, and I don't have a position on this, I just, children, their well-being would be my priority. Do we not have to make sure that we aren't throwing a spanner in the works for children who are maybe already struggling for identity, you know, the way we have different hormones that peak in guys and girls at that time, that we're sort of saying that, you know, a lot of stages that we all went through to say, ah, well, that actually could be you being this. So in our efforts to sort of, as we must protect that one child, do we not need to maybe make sure that we're not creating problems for a greater number of children? And I'm not saying we would, but I'm just wondering, has that been properly analysed before we take this really quite significant leap in teaching this in fifth and sixth classes? What's your view on that?
Like, honestly, Greg, you know, I don't remember anyone I knew growing up being having difficulties with identifying with their gender. I mean, it wasn't spoken about.
But when boys go through puberty, and just to be clear, many boys grow breasts temporarily.
Yeah.
You know, that's just as an example, just to try and sort of put a line under the point I was trying to make. I don't want to girls.
Actually, that's a very good way of putting it forward. And because of that, it is a good idea to have a professional person to come in and speak in a classroom. Now, I remember myself 450,000 years ago
when I was in school, and we
were allowed to write on a little piece of paper our questions that went into a box, and it was all anonymously done. And I actually distinctly remember being surprised at the level of questions and the things that people really needed the answer to. If I was to be honest, having reared five children, I was probably lax in this department. I didn't know. And I think that not only should the children be educated, but their parents should be educated, and the teachers, particularly the teachers, should be really well educated. I spoke to a teacher about this quite recently, and she literally had to sit down and study the pronouns, the nouns, all the different ways of addressing her pupils, so she didn't make a mistake. Because we've seen about what's happened in when trouble hits at a school's door.
Yeah, of course. We'll come back to this. There's more to tease out on it. But an initial sort of input from you, Reverend Mark Lockridge.
Thank you. Yes, Greg, in many ways, I agree with what you're saying. My great concern is the welfare, for all of us, the welfare of the children. When and should gender identity be taught in schools? I think I've got three issues here. One is, I think it's based on a flawed premise. Professor O'Connor said that, you know, gender is seen as a key marker. And I think this is, you know, I think she was stating it in a negative way, and I agree with her if that's the case. I think whenever we teach people that their identity is found in a single thing, identity is found in their gender, their identity is found in their sexuality, that is an awful narrowing of the rich, beautiful complexity of what it is to be a human being. And it's cruel, and it's diminishing. So that's my first problem with it as a concept. My second problem is that not only is it based on a wrong premise, but it's also damaging. And you alluded to this when you said that this is a time of turmoil for young people. And what we're doing is introducing at this moment a set of thoughts that we're introducing them into a confused environment. We know from studies that our sense of sexuality and our sense of gender moves around in this period of time. And so to tell people that they're to get their identity from that is to tell them to try and find their identity in something unstable. It's like telling them to jump onto a spinning roundabout.
But Mark, in relation to that, I just want to be clear. What I'm trying to do, I'm not stationing opinion here. I'm trying to create, I'm trying to sort of imagine what people listening in the cars or at work or at home might be putting through here. But the fundamental of this, basis of this, and if people go, and everyone should go through this curriculum from the start to the finish and watch the support videos as well, because, you know, lots of people comment on this stuff but they don't actually look at the core material, and that drives me crazy. One of the support videos for this, because I did go through it all, believe it or not, one of the key support, the basis of this is that, and there's a case study of a three-year-old, and it is accepted that a three-year-old knows their gender. And there's one case of a boy who says, "Mummy, I'm a boy on the outside and I'm a girl on the inside." Now, it could be reversed because I'm going off memory here. So it is not just, so we don't, that is the basis of the decision-making process to say that, right, we need to start talking about this to fifth and sixth classes, just to put a bit further context into it. So you don't accept that then? I presume, Mark, you wouldn't accept that.
I think what we need to do is we need to deal with things at a biological and a physiological level, yes, but there is an ideological level that's going on here that I think is profoundly untested, untried, and the results are only beginning to trickle in. And what we found is that those who have followed this ideology through and acted on it are now coming back and saying, actually, why did nobody ever ask me about all these other underlying issues in my life that led me to take these decisions? And rather than, in a sense, there being some sort of, whenever something becomes raised like this and popularized like this, if I remember correctly, the stats for gender dysphoria, actual gender dysphoria, are 1 in 30,000. That's small. And yet, and that's not to minimize the anguish that people go through.
But there are statistics from the United States that shows there's, I think it's 35% of students class themselves in the LGBT plus. But I also have to be very conscious, Mark and Claire and Pat, and jump in as you see fit here, that if I were a trans person listening to this conversation now, I might feel that I am being scrubbed out, that I'm not being recognized, not from Claire particularly or Pat perhaps, but I'm not.
Let me finish
the proposition first. That I am not. I am being. It's as if I do not exist. That I am. I am the result of some sort of mental health issue that wasn't picked up. That I don't exist. That I am not me. That I am not who I am. That God did not create me like I believe He did. If they have a faith. For an example, I think we have to be really careful in our language as well whilst we do this and ensure we move forward best, that we don't casually
talk as if people don't exist. Let me come to that, Greg, if I may. What I'd be wanting to say, to some, and I do have friends who are transgender, and what I would be wanting to say to anybody is, you see, I don't regard people as human doings, as simply the result of their identity coming from what they do. I see people as human beings made by God. So I'd be wanting to say to them, listen, my dear, dear, dear friend, you are a work of art. You are made by God. You have meaning and value and dignity that comes from God. And so I will honor you and I will respect you and I will love you and I will care for you. But let me encourage you to see your body as a gift from God, to be explored and to be accepted as a gift. And why is it that we always want to... Instead, we say, this is what I think, therefore I must change my body. Why don't we ever say, this is my body? Maybe I need to reconsider how I'm thinking and feeling in this. Yet we live in a world where
feelings have been given. So you're asking people, you're asking someone to deny. You're asking someone effectively to almost take it as a penance from God, it sounds like, and to deny who they believe to the very core that they are and leap into faith and live their life as somebody else, as they might see it, Mark.
We have made, you see, from Freud onwards, somebody put it well. They said the self has been psychologized and psychology has been sexualized, and we have accepted that. I want to challenge that whole framework and say that it's not a healthy framework to grow up in. And so what you've just articulated is what people think, and yet I don't think it's profoundly helpful for them to think that.
Claire,
I want to help them step outside that.
Do either of you want to come in on that? Claire, maybe? You look poised. Oh, Pat, sorry. Pat, go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead, Claire.
No, go on. You go on.
Well, I suppose, I mean, I want to come back that the question, what does it mean to be a boy? What does it mean to be a girl? I mean, in a way, it varies by cross-culturally. So, for example, in Western society, in Ireland, we think there still is a view that girls aren't good at maths. God, in India, in Portugal, like, it is one of the taken for granted that girls are good at maths. So, I mean, it's the same girls and boys, but the question, so your three-year-old, what does, it may well be, you know, what does it mean to say I'm a girl on the inside? Is it because of the, I mean, even the clothes we wear, like the turn of the century, boys up to a certain age wore dresses. You've seen all
photographs. Yeah, but it's down to who you feel you are, to your very core. You see, I think some people seem to be associating one's gender with the clothes that they wear or who they're intimate with. But
their interests, their lifestyle.
You woke up this morning and you knew you were a woman. You didn't necessarily do womany things, but you knew you were a woman. Claire, do you want
to? Still have to ask the question, what does it mean? And how does
it's
that
what
vary?
You feel. It's who you are. Claire?
I would think, Pat, that it, my thoughts on it are, I'm just thinking of this as a mother. I have a child. And my child is confused about their gender. It's gender identity. And as Greg said, a three-year-old child who said, Mummy, I'm a boy on the outside and a girl on the inside. God made that child. You can't say
But that can we accept that, Claire? And I know where you're coming from. And to be honest with you, listening to this video that's put up with this documentation, there was 11 cases and these were the examples, and it says, so it's proven, and the conclusion was from the lady who I should remember the name of, but I don't, but the proven off the back of that testimony of that child, I think it was stated, and I must get the clip, so it's proven that by the time you get to national school, you have a sense of your identity, or if you're trapped in the wrong body. Now, you kind of have to accept that that's the case then, to sort of say, right, let's start teaching this in national school. I would say a lot of people wouldn't accept that's the situation, Claire.
They wouldn't accept that there is such
a three-year-old. I don't know. It's very difficult.
Sorry, go ahead, Claire.
No, I was just going to say, I honestly haven't experienced this with anyone I'm close to. Mm. I did interview a 14-year-old one day, and he told me that he was gender neutral. And when I questioned him, and I have to be honest and say that it was because of my ignorance, I wasn't quite sure how to handle the situation at 14. He did say to me, well, I've had no sexual experience. This is just me. I think I'm gender neutral. And then when I continued to question him, he had seen on social media what gender neutrality was. I left that day feeling uncomfortable because I wasn't sure if he was or if he wasn't, or had he seen something on social media and thought that it related to him.
And I think Claire and Mark wants to come in, but then we have to pray. I think this talks to what we have to make sure is that we get this right. And I think I want to be guided. And I want to know what the right thing to do is. Claire, it sounds to me very much like you do as well.
Definitely.
And I think Mark's quite locked in his view, and Pat can outline hers.
I want to make sure
the children are best cared for. Go ahead, Mark.
My view isn't locked in terms of, accept my view or take the high road. It's because I think the whole premise of the thing is dangerous and harmful and restricting and narrowing and confusing and untested. And as we're watching the results coming in, a three-year-old can think that. And as Professor O'Connor points out, what has led them to consider what a boy is and what a girl is? Mm. And then there's the 14-year-old and the impact of social media. And, you know, whenever we're teenagers, we're confused about everything. And I'd mean that I was a teenager, deeply confused about a lot of things and not knowing who I was and wanting to find out. And I'm just glad that this element of greater confusion wasn't thrown into the mix for me.
Yeah, because when we are teenagers, I'm definitely going to make sure, and if there's anyone who wants to advocate in a different way, please come on and we'll have a very respectful conversation where you can explain where we might not be wrong or not. But as again, going back to my childhood, and this is why I need education, you kind of join gangs and groups and mods and teds and goths and all that kind of stuff because you wanted to belong to, you wanted to belong to something. Maybe this is much more deeper than that, and I have a severe lack of understanding, which I'm really, really open to be educated on. Pat, do you want the last 30 seconds before we cut to a break?
I mean, in a way, I want a world where if you're a boy and you're interested in sewing and frilly dresses, no problem. I want a world where if you want to hang around with girls and you're a boy, no problem. If you're a girl and you want to play football, like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that was seen as, oh, my God, you had an identity problem. You join the boys. If you want to climb trees, go to the Antarctica, no problem. You know, in a way, I want a world where there's a more relaxed attitude, and it's not effectively, we're not locking people into what I regard as 1950s versions of femininity and masculinity.
Because it is a big, big step for this to become part of the curriculum. Like, we are taking a huge step. And we said in a previous conversation that a lot of this was formulated really when the country's actually changed a little bit. I think it went very far through, and we're seeing what's happening in sports and different things where there's a bit of a pulling back and stuff, but this was all formulated really when, you know, we went further than we're going now. But anyway, it's going to be taught to fifth and sixth class. It's not horrendous commentary or information, and maybe us adults need to give our young people a little bit of credit as to what information they already know, and this actually just, you know, makes it make sense for them. We have to be careful with that too, don't we? I mean, we're all talking historically here from our own experiences, but I know my kids have got friends that are all different types of people, let me put it like that there, and to them they're all equal.
Mm-hmm. Which is great, and which is what we want.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. We're in the midst of the Friday panel with Reverend Mark Lockridge, Claire Ronan, Professor Pat O'Connor. And I think, Claire, it's a difficult conversation that a lot of people back out of the last one we had there, isn't it? Because no one wants to offend or upset anyone, but we want to make sure that we learn and we understand and we chart the right path. It's a toughie, isn't it? And I think particularly on social media, you can sort of see if you slightly step out one way or other, you know, there's a pile on, because and everyone's afraid to talk about it as a result, because you can be called all sorts of names depending on how someone interprets your comments. I don't think that's healthy. We have to be able to talk, Claire, don't we? And no one here has any interest in denying anyone or offending anyone. And I think we're all open to sort of learning, because we are all learning a bit, Claire, aren't we?
Well, we are. And I mean, you know, we're also learning as parents, and we're learning as aunts and uncles and broadcasters. And all these sort of topics Ireland has changed. And you alluded to this earlier, Greg, and you're right. I mean, I think what I see is Ireland has changed. People are much more open. And if I was a mother of a child who was struggling with their gender identity, I would be worried sick. And, you know, it's great that these conversations are being had and that people mightn't feel so alone, because it must be very difficult to have this in your family and try and deal with it in the best way and not say the wrong thing or not upset them. You know, there'd be a huge education. Now, actually, as you said earlier, I would like to learn more about this. Because particularly with the pronouns and the nouns and, you know, how to behave properly and use the right language. But I think it must be very difficult.
Exactly. Okay. Lots and lots of people, Professor Pat O'Connor, have decided not to pay their TV licence. RTÉ's down an absolute fortune. There's a 50 million hole that's probably going to have to be plugged in the budget. We were talking about rainy day funds and access for the general population. I suppose, listen, we had announcement of the autumn schedule today, and it probably doesn't help that the show's like, you know, people travelling to Turkey to examine people getting their teeth whitened and all that kind of crack and the amount of money that might cost. What do you think the reaction will be to the public when the government opens the purse to the tune of probably 50-odd million to support RTÉ, Professor?
Well, I suppose, I mean, I do think that it is annoying. The whole thing has been very annoying. But in a way, like, the annoyance well goes back to, I do remember when Pat Kenny was paid 970,000, right? Anyone else remember that?
Can you imagine?
Yeah, nobody saw
Jerry Palmer. Ryan was on it too, I think, and a few others. It's amazing.
Anyway, so, I mean, but in a way, I have paid my TV. I did delay for a week, right? And then I paid my own TV license because I thought, well, in a way, if they do change the rules, surely they'd give me credit for that, you know? Because you can't just pay your, you know, in a way like saying...
You had a one-week protest.
You can't sort of expect things to be applied retrospectively, you know. I basically didn't do X because I knew the government were going to change the rules next week, you know. That doesn't hold. That kind of thinking is illogical, basically, and unacceptable. Mm. So the current rule is that I do think it, you know, I did understand that, and it was very... in a way, good and bad of the judge who said, who let off all these people from the penalties that they should have got for not paying their TV license, because he said with all this carry on, he was doing a minimal reinforcement. So, but I don't, you see, in a way, I think that is very healthy kind of to see the institutions protesting against.
Did you pay your TV license? Through gritted teeth?
Yeah, but I mean, in a way, of course. And I mean, I do think that the whole, again, the business, the whole thing has been really badly handled. Okay. I was horrified that so little attention was paid to Deloitte's role. The internal auditors, also paid by the taxpayer, right? Who eventually woke up in 2022, but seemed to be asleep at the wheel 2017 to 2019.
Well, I also maintain the Oireachtas Media Committee have got a free pass on this as well. We actually pay their wages to keep an eye on this stuff. We don't have terribly long, only 3 minutes, so a minute and a half each. Claire, you work extensively in the independent media. You know exactly the role it plays and what have you. Do you begrudge the licence fee to RTE? And do you welcome the bailout that's due from government to the tune of 50-odd million?
Well, that's a really big question. I paid my TV licence, first of all, because I was too scared not to pay it. And I also don't want to end up in Sligo Court and on the front of the Sligo Champion. I know the Weekender might let me off. But anyway, I did pay my TV licence. Did I pay it through gritted teeth? Good question. No, I didn't. Because when anything happens, we turn to the news and RTE. Yes, you're right. Some of the programming isn't the most exciting thing on the planet, and a lot of reruns. I don't think people are going to be too happy, Greg, when they see what's going to have to be paid to keep RTE going. I think, and I do contribute to a lot of programmes on RTE for which you are very badly paid. And a lot of work goes into some of the contributions that are done, and I'm delighted to do it. But there is a massive gap between what the ordinary staff are being paid and what their talent, as they call it, as you know yourself, the talent is the presenter. And that is not fair. And they need such a shaking. Now, this Kevin Bankhurst looks like he's going to do it. But can I just say one thing? I thought that taking Ryan Tuberty in front of the PAC, of him being questioned for 7 hours over and over again, of leading questions going to his agent, Noel Kelly, as which, what did you sell in Cadbury's, all that sort of thing.
There's some of it very unsavoury, I think, some of the questions.
It was horrible to watch. Horrible.
An awful bit of grandstanding goes on. And I'd love to tease that out with you a little more, but we don't have time. Reverend Lockridge, 50 mil going out of the budget to RTE, it seems. It could be up to 100, could be as less as 25. But anyway, in other words, what the bottom line is if you don't pay your licence, you're going to pay the money anyway. It's just going to come out of general taxation.
Yeah, it seems that way. And I think, you know, I was talking to a guy who works a lot with the media in the UK, and he was surprised at how much, in a sense, in Ireland, the media, not broad brushing it completely, but by and large, the national media back the government's agenda and don't question stuff. And I think that's deeply unhealthy for a country. I think there should be a lot more questioning goes on, a lot more hard questions asked. And
but if you do that, you don't get access, you see. That's the problem. Your access gets withdrawn if the questions aren't favourable.
You know, but the people need to learn that you've been put into power and that they have to answer questions. That's the way it is. And fair play for you asking questions and going ahead.
Reverend Mark Lockridge, thanks very much. Great to have you on the show as well. It's been a pleasure. Claire, you might come back. Did you enjoy it enough as to come back? You thought you
I most certainly did. It's been a pleasure.
You thought the pay was bad in RTE. Come here. Claire, we'll chat again. Thank you so very
much.
And we really appreciate your time. It is greatly appreciated. And last but not least, always enjoy listening to you, Professor Pat O'Connor. Thanks for your time.
A pleasure,
right,
Greg.
Bye-bye.